and welcome to this week's episode of Would You Data Scientist? I am joined this week by Gerardo Limas. Hi, how are you doing, Gerardo?
I'm doing fine here in one grey, typical London morning here in the south of London.
I've got blue skies in the south of London.
I got grey, so it's very weird. It must be a microclimate.
I will push them over to you. Hopefully you'll get there soon. It's beautiful. Yeah. How are you? How's life treating you?
Yeah, things are fine here. I mean, basically you're trying to live with the aftershocks of the COVID, all this COVID situation, etc. At least now we are able to yet to travel, etc. I mean, we are all triple back here.
Good.
Same. Yes, things are.
Good. Has it affected business much for you?
It has affected in the sense that although remote working is very productive. On the other hand, it's a little more difficult to create new relationships in some industries. I mean, there are some industries like the financial industry that is still it's a little bit more old fashioned, and they actually like to see people and sit in a room to develop some rapport and then go ahead and start some projects.
That's exactly in some of the same
areas. It's an interesting thing. I can see the difference between this industry, like old fashioned kind of traditional finance, and the new fledging cryptocurrency kind of finance, which is the complete opposite. In that world, basically, it actually does not matter where are you sitting or who are you. I mean, you can live as an avatar on a Discord server, and people are very happy just to share and collaborate and develop projects very, very easily. So it's very interesting to be sitting in between the old traditional finance and the new cryptocurrency world.
Perfect. So we're going to come on to cryptocurrency, and we're going to be talking a lot about blockchain in this episode. But first of all, Gerardo, what is your favorite piece of tech ever?
My favorite piece of tech ever is, I'm an old-fashioned guy, so basically I still remember when I learned to program on my old TI-49 pocket calculator. That was the beginning of everything. The funny thing is that coding remains very, very similar. If you knew how to code on assembly language, it's just very interesting to see how everything has developed until now, where you can pretty much work in all these extremely high level languages, etc., and you can develop different kind of ways of looking at the world and modeling the world.
Brilliant. I remember those calculators at school. I didn't use anything other than the calculator. No, wouldn't even have a clue where to start. So how did you, can you talk me through your career and what you're doing now and how you got into it, please?
Yes. So basically, probably my career is a little bit unorthodox, because I did, starting with that pocket calculator, I got very involved in electronics and then computer science, and obviously in order to do all of that, you need a good level of math. I did a degree in engineering in Mexico, and then I went to the States to do a PhD in computer science and electrical engineering, still combining both worlds. But then at the end of my PhD program, I got approached by a headhunter who told me that there was a huge demand for quantitative people in the finance world. Yeah, for personal reasons, I had a personal interest to move to the UK. It was a time when the partners of European Union citizens were able to to come on work, and because I was married to a French citizen, we were able to come here and work in London. And the main industry in London was finance. So I left a very quantitative academic kind of world in the States at MIT, and then I came here to work in finance, in what is for anyone who has worked in finance, for anyone who has read this famous book called Liar's Poker from Michael Lewis, they will recognize that when you join a company, it doesn't actually matter where are you coming from. They don't care anymore. Once you got in, basically, you're supposed to start from the bottom and then show that you can go up.
Yep.
So it was quite a shock in the sense that yes, I was used to working as an isolated researcher in a company, very very cocoon, pretty much in an ivory tower kind of environment, mm-hmm. and then I had to just dive in the deep end of this capitalism frontier. So I had to go there, basically start from fetching coffees, doing photocopies, despite having a high degree in computer science, whatever. But what I found interesting is that while I was there, although I was working on the financial side, basically on the front office, trying to figure out how to improve the bottom. And how to improve the profits of the company, I realized that there was a huge divide between the front end and the back office IT people. But I also because of my background, I realized that there was a huge amount of information out there that was being wasted because there was a lack of communication between these two worlds. I realized that from the beginning, But I just kept working on the front end of finance. I became a portfolio manager. Then I went to work at a hedge fund and then JP Morgan. But by 2015, I started to get restless because I started to hear news that this academic. That you had all these companies developing AI tools, particularly DeepMind, and they had developed this tool that was now able to teach itself chess and teach itself Go and pretty much beat any human competitor. And because of that, I said that I wanted to go back and figure out what was going on the quantitative AI kind of world. So I left JP Morgan, as I said, to go back and try to figure out how could I use these skills that I have acquired in both worlds to improve the operations of my financial institution customers. And this is pretty much basically how I got into this kind of data science role. And when I was looking at the description of what I was doing, I found out this description that data science at this intersection of three different kind of skills. So on one hand, you have the computational skills, then you have the mathematical and statistical skills. And then intersected with knowledge of the domain, so basically business knowledge, and this is where I try to provide value to my clients. Basically, the important thing for them is that not only I'm able to understand what they're saying on their front office, but also I'm able to translate that and work with these two others. Set of people. Basically, I see myself as a bridge between these different set of people, which usually they tend to work in different silos, and they find it very very difficult to communicate and express mm-hmm. what they really want. This is I took a few time.
We find that a lot. I used to work in actuarial recruitment, and you definitely find that there's, I mean, the people who work in the front office, they've got better communication than the, generally, than the people in the back office. And it is quite difficult to find that common ground. So you've got a real interest, because we had a chat the other day, didn't we? And I saw that you were interested in blockchain, and I mentioned that I was looking maybe to do some NFTs because I do photography as well. And we had a really good chat about blockchain. So we've not really spoken about it on the podcast before. So can you please kind of give me what is blockchain? What is the general overview of blockchain and how it works, if you can do that?
Yeah, I'll do a very simple oversimplification. Perfect. Of blockchain. I just want to quickly comment that there is, I consider myself to be an agnostic, so I try not to take any kind of partisan view. And this is one of the things that is very problematic in blockchain. Usually, you either will have it, the fanatical, the people who believe that blockchain is the solution for everything in the world, and then you have the complete skeptics that attack it and basically believe that there's zero intrinsic value. And the problem is that because they're so partisan, all the research that they do is biased, and they keep having this problem of confirmation bias, in which they only will take the arguments in their favor or against the other person. So but going back to blockchain, I think the basic thing that you have to visualize is just a spreadsheet, Excel spreadsheet, where you have where in every row you have a few numbers. Basically, it's a big ledger. So in every row you'll have a set of numbers. Let's say the address and whether they're sending some tokens to another address. So basically, you can think that every row is a combination of the address where the tokens are coming from and how much are they sending to the other address. So you have three numbers. It's a lot more complicated than that, but basically, in essence, this is a visualization of a blockchain, something where you have all this layer that keeps increasing. That it has to be maintained. All these transactions keep coming every minute or every second, and someone needs to put them into the ledger. Now, usually in the past, in the traditional finance, you'll have a centralized ledger. That ledger will be stored with a trusted agent. But what these people, the blockchain developers, decided that they didn't want to trust anyone. And in order to have that ledger, in reality, what they wanted to do was to distribute it across multiple people, so that everyone who wanted could have a copy of the ledger. And then the ledger that is going to be the official one is going to be the one that is the trusted one by most of the ledgers. So they will reach a consensus across all the different ledgers across that are scattered across the world, and they will decide, okay, well, the official one is the one that is trusted by most people. This is a very oversimplification. There is a lot more complicated spinning wheels around there, etc. So basically you have this ledger, and then you have these people who maintain these ledgers in a distributed way. And here's where the magic comes. So why will all these people put their ledger on their computer to do this? And the way that the blockchain developers figure out is, why don't as in part of this process, whenever this ledger keeps being updated because there are transactions, so why don't we give them some tokens that also store into the same blockchain as a reward. So this is the reason why you have all these people who maintain these ledgers across the world is because they're being given some tokens. So this is the beginning of the magic. But then when it really becomes magic is when someone else outside of this world decided, okay, actually I can use this layer for something else, but I don't want to be spending time or resources maintaining the ledger. I mean, by now it's a very expensive process, but yeah, maybe they want to do is say, okay, well, I'll use these tokens to be able to perform some operations on the ledger. Let's say that you want to record some information on the ledger for some reason. In order to do that, you are requested to pay in these tokens. So if you want to store information in the ledger for some reason, you need to do a transaction and pay in that token. If you're not a miner and you were never paid in the token, the easiest way is to get it, the token, from someone else who already has it.
Right.
And this is in magic. So basically, at one moment, someone decided, okay, for me, it's easier just to buy this token from that guy, get it myself, and now use it to record information in the ledger. Because this ledger is distributed, it turns out that it's extremely secure, and obviously all this crypto element make sure that it's not, that the ledgers themselves are not hackable. And this is what it has, I mean, the Bitcoin is the proof of concept. Basically, it has shown that it's possible. Bitcoin has not been hacked. Whenever you hear about hacking, it's not about that ledger, but rather about applications on top of a blockchain or other people who got hacked. So it's not a ledger. It remains there, and it's and all the information that people have stored there is actually still going on there.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it gets to a point when all these applications, when the value of the token becomes too expensive, it turns out that the ability to store information on the ledger becomes way too expensive. So that kind of, so this is, that can kill a little bit the ability to use the ledger for practical purposes. But to give you an example, I'm working with this is a separate kind of business, but I can talk about them because there's something interesting stuff. But basically, I'm working with a company that's called BottleBits. It's a whiskey company that fractionalizes bottles of whiskey.
Yep. My friend Robin and Mike would be very interested in those.
yes, interesting. But basically, when you look at these kind of applications, you can, if you want to be able to store the information somewhere, you can decide to go through different kind of platforms. In the past, basically, you can say, okay, well, what they can do is that they can set up a centralized server where they store the information of the clients. And then they need to spend money on putting that database on the cloud. They need to spend money making sure that the database is set up in a secure way. So you need to hire security experts, etc. But what he decided to do is basically, well, what can we do on the blockchain? And for his purpose, basically, he can store all the information on the blockchain one at a time. If you go for the right blockchain, the one that is cheap, you can store information for like 1 cent per transaction. So suddenly for him it becomes very cost effective. So, well, actually, instead of developing a ledger that I have to do to label where all these tokens are, I can simply just do it on a public blockchain. And not only that, but my clients will see that everything is there. And because public blockchains have shown to be not hackable, they will know that if suddenly his company suffers a blackout, they will know that all information is there,
right?
Safe.
I've got so many questions.
Okay.
So there's more than one blockchain. So for example, F have got their own blockchain, right? And they've got their own cryptocurrency. So they're the tokens that you would pay to get onto that blockchain. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yes. For instance, Ether calls that process gas.
Yes. Okay.
So you want to store information on Ether, you have to pay the fee that is called gas. And this is when it becomes a little bit annoying, because every blockchain decides to call similar things in different
names. Yeah, and then they've got their own currency.
Names. And then you have fanatical people who say, well, my blockchain is the best, and they don't want to deal with the other ones, etc.
Yeah. So you've got the blockchain, and you said it's shared between, the ledger is shared between lots and lots and lots of different people. So when something's added to the blockchain, how does that work? Does one person enter it?
Exactly. No, that transaction has to be propagated across the all the different ledgers, and it's only when it reaches a consensus, then it becomes the official ledger, and then everybody has to take that ledger. And in that process, basically, what happens is that there is usually one of the people is the person who becomes the first one to put it on the ledger.
Yep.
And he gets he or she or gets rewarded for doing that.
Right. Okay.
And this is where you start to hear about this concept of proof of work. So basically, what happens, for instance, in Bitcoin is that the person who is allowed to put the next block into the ledger will receive Bitcoin. And in order to do that, they need to solve a very complex problem that will give them the right to add the block.
Yep.
And then to receive the reward, which is, in their case, is Bitcoin.
Okay. So for example, if I were to put an NFT somewhere to sell and go onto the blockchain, I would need to prove that that work was mine, where it came from, with the metadata. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. So this is the tricky bit. What you put on the network, as I said, is a row of data. So you, if you want to add an NFT, what you would have to do is you have to mint an NFT. So you have to add another row of data on the blockchain. You will have to say, okay, I'm going to create this new address that represents an NFT.
Right.
And the tricky bit is that actually, because the things are becoming too expensive, people are trying to minimize the amount of information that you can put on the ledger, and they did a shortcut. So instead of putting the full information about the NFT, all they did was to say, okay, well, when you create an NFT, you will only store on this ledger, basically, who's the first owner of the NFT, and then a pointer to where the NFT is, where the art is actually stored. And this is the bit where people can really get very either creative or malicious. For anyone who's doing NFTs, I recommend that they read this blog that was developed by the founder of Signal, where basically he was able to show how. Let me see if I have the name. Actually, I'm going to send it to you via.
That'd be amazing. And I'll get it put on the show notes for everybody, and I'll certainly have a read of it. It's just so interesting. And I know not everybody agrees with NFTs. I think my friend Rosie's not sure about it. We've not spoken in detail, and I've not told her that I'm going to have a go. But my somebody I know, Faces have just started doing NFTs, and it's great. You know, I think it's great to be able to spread art and
on the chart. So this is the article that everyone who's doing NFTs has to read.
Okay, that's great. I'll link that to the show notes. So it's my first impressions of Web3. Is that how you say it, or Web Cubes?
Web3. Yeah, exactly.
Lovely.
I call it Web3. But basically, but just to get a feel of what he did, basically, he created an NFT, because the NFT, in reality, what we store on the blockchain is just a link to a URL.
Yeah.
What he did was say, okay, well, on that link to URL, I'm going to put whoever links to that URL is going to be able to see different things. So if you open it, for instance, an OpenSea, you will see one picture. You open another NFT marketplace, you will see something else. But when you open it in your wallet, you'll see a poop emoji.
Okay, brilliant. I'll have a look at that and then and share it in the show notes. Thank you so much for sharing that. So let's talk about data science now. What advice would you give somebody? Well, let's talk about the whole thing. What advice would you give to somebody who wanted to work in data science or blockchain or something like that, that's coming either from academia or wanting to pivot into it from another role? What advice would you give them?
Yes. I think I said in the beginning, basically, yeah, the kind of the classical way of thinking of what a data science person is as the intersection of these three fields. So yeah, mathematics, computer science, and then domain knowledge. And for so anyone who's going from academia, I'm pretty sure they would have a good knowledge of math and computer science. But the bit that is going to be missing is the domain knowledge, basically mm-hmm. the ability to understand what the people on the business side, what is what they want, and the ability to understand could be the limitations of what they can offer and what cannot be done, and actually what things actually could be done that the person on the business side doesn't realize that can be improved. So for anyone coming from academia, yeah, they need to have some sort of understanding of in which kind of field they would like to be working, because data science at the end, basically, because of this extra component of domain knowledge, it means that you need to spend some time trying to understand the business side of a project.
Perfect. What's the favorite project you've ever done? What's your, I don't know, the most fun or the most challenging?
Yes. Well, actually, something that was very fun is when, and that was already in the early 2000s, when after working a little bit at a bank, I realized that there was a huge amount of communication that was going on from one place to the other as text, and they had basically, in the middle, people who were just gathering that information manually and putting everything into a relational database.
Okay.
And that was a typical case of people not talking between silos, because on the front end, everything at the time in the early 2000s, most of the deals, et cetera, trades were being done on a chat on the beginnings of a chat system to Bloomberg, and they were just sending information back to a assistant who will then go and gather all the information manually and put it into a relational database. So on one hand, you had the people on the IT who understood, okay, these people need to have all this information. Let's create a relational database that is very easy and fast to analyze and create reports, but they didn't care about how the data was being entered there. The people in the front end didn't know whether there was any way to enter easily the data into the system, Yeah. To be honest, I mean, the reason why I got interested there is because when I just started, they told me, okay, well, now you go ahead and write all the information manually into the database, which I found pretty absurd. So, I developed in 2 weeks. I said, so I'm going to do my own kind of NLP parser to do that, and it worked. And the complete flow was automatic.
Yeah.
And then from that, they said, okay, well, actually, I can do a company out of this. And I left. I briefly left the industry to do a startup based on this concept. And on the technical side, everything was going very well. I mean, nowadays, with a bunch of Python libraries, you can replicate it, the same thing. So this is the other thing that I really like about the current environment, where you can just develop all these applications very, very quickly. Just looking at the open, whether it's already been built and open source, etc. At the time that didn't exist, and also at the time, the issues were that. While I started the company at the top of the internet boom, then the internet collapsed and suddenly the funding, and I got pulled out of the rock. So I ended up having to go back into finance.
Oh, bless you. What do you think data science is going to look like in the future, or what do you hope it will look like?
Yes. So again, going back to the intersection of roles. So, It's becoming more and more difficult to find people who can do everything, who can live in that intersection and do everything. So not only that, but also, I strongly believe that there are more areas that now need to live on this data science intersection, and one of the most important. And I think that two very important fields. One is the ethical side of data science, and then I think I know that this is one of the topics that one of your favorite topics, and also the regulatory side, and they go hand in hand basically. I mean, ethics will drive regulations with a lag, but this is something that a data science project now requires to have basically, and this is what I find with my clients, because I bring at the moment I still bring an intersection of computer science and math and domain, but what I find nowadays is that in commercial applications, I mean, the regulatory side is extremely important, and usually then we're seeing the same problems. I mean, usually usually a lawyer will be parachuted into to see what can be done or not.
Yeah.
And we see the same problems of lack of communication. The lawyer will say, okay, well, no, this cannot be done. And people will say, well, of course you can do, you can just do it technically, this and that, and you can get all this data for free. But and the lawyer will say, no, with the new rules that are being developed and new GDPR stuff, you should make sure that all the personal data cannot be used for this and that. And again, those are things that, there is a lack of communication between the legal side and the technical side. Sometimes even the business side, there's more of a conflict. It has to come back together, and everyone needs to be able to talk in the same language. Which at the end of the day requires that data science has to be taught in all kind of different careers. I mean, if you are a lawyer, you need to understand what is happening. If you are academic, you should be aware of what are the legal implications. I mean, obviously, we have seen lots of examples of academics getting Facebook data and then not realizing. That excuse will not be viable. And then obviously then you have the ethical point, with the parts are going to lead what things should be done, particularly with the AI and the AI applications, that people need to figure out what are the repercussions of some of the systems that they do, just like there's another great AI article about one of the AI leads on Facebook.
Yeah.
That suddenly realized that whatever they were using to optimize and to maximize the amount of time that people spend on Facebook had very strong social repercussions.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
All these things, they need to be taken into account.
Absolutely. So talking about, ethical things and morals, I was approached yesterday by somebody who said there's a loophole in the tax. An HMRC have said that it is a loophole and you can, get away with not paying your tax, basically. Am I interested? And I was like, no, absolutely, I'm not interested. I said, you've got to do things ethically. I said, morally, that's completely wrong. If you owe something, I'm completely going off on a tangent here. If you owe something, you need to pay it, right? I said, loopholes. He's like, but it's legal. And I was like, I don't care if it's legal or not. There are some big, big, big companies that are not paying the tax that they should be paying. Yes, it might be legal, but it's not right. So are there any things within data science and AI that are legal but aren't right? Are there any things that are that are ethical that people are doing that they shouldn't be doing?
Well, this is what I mentioned, this case of the AI guy working for Facebook. So basically, this is the extreme point. I will try to get the article. Let me see. But basically, in a case, what Facebook is doing, for instance, is that they want to maximize the amount of time that a user spends on Facebook, because the longer you spend on Facebook, the higher the probability you're going to see ads.
And the
revenue comes from ads, so therefore they want you to spend as much time as possible on.
Do you not think that's counterproductive of Facebook? Because I know
this is what I'm saying. So it is legal for them to try to maximize their revenues.
Yeah,
I mean that's completely legal, and it is the reason why companies are done. I mean, you create a company because you want them to maximize revenues. Once you maximize revenues, then obviously, hopefully. They're going to be paying those taxes somewhere, right? Now,
hopefully.
That's another part. Whether they do or not is a separate part. But basically, on the legal side, yes, legally they can. The science is being used to try to maximize the amount you spend there. But again, as you're saying, is that correct from a social perspective? Do you want people to be spending all their time on Facebook?
Not even that. I think if people find out that you're doing that, they're going to stop using the platform altogether.
Everyone knows that Facebook interest is for you to spend most of your time there. So
people already know that. So many people that won't go on Facebook. And I mean, I'm only on there because I've got business pages on there. They've got me. I've got those customers on there. We could talk about this forever, couldn't we?
Exactly.
Let's talk about diversity a little bit. What have you seen diversity wise throughout your career? Gender split, ethnicity split, that kind of thing. Has it been quite even, or is it getting better?
I think ethnically speaking, it has been quite even. I'm Mexican initially. Yeah, when you're doing quantitative degrees, I mean, what people care It's about your quantitative skills, so they don't really look at the ethnicity that much. But on the gender, definitely there's a huge lack of women working in the industry, I think. That's a pity. I don't know if you know about this case of this MIT researcher. I really wanted to talk about this. Her name is Joy Wolamwini.
Okay.
She was working at MIT doing a research, doing a demo on, and she started using a, yes, she wanted to do a demo about a visual demo where she would project on her face a different kind of images, etc. And for that, she was using a commercial face recognition system.
Okay.
Now, she's African-American. She was unable to find any system that worked for her.
Wow.
And that led her to figure out why. Well, why is that happening? And there's extremely good documentary. It's called Coded Bias in Netflix.
Yep.
Where they explain the whole process. But basically from... that completely shows the need to have a diverse team in a project. Yeah, the fact that she and her other teammates were not they needed to have a white mask put on top of their face to have this demo working was a huge eye opener. Which to be fair, I mean now at MIT they just started this AI center. I mean they funded it with $1 billion. But one of their main goals, is to look at all these ethical issues that are being arise from AI.
Brilliant.
You should make sure that there's a social understanding of what AI is being used for.
Perfect.
So you can say because you have a diverse team.
Yeah.
That the team was able to identify this problem, which snowball into now one of the three main priorities of this new $1 billion institute is to make sure that that AI remains ethical.
Good. I really like that. I didn't know that. So if you can share that with me afterwards, I'll put that on the show notes as well. So one last question, Gerardo. We've got lots of billionaires in this world. Do you think that they could possibly build an evil supervillain to take over the world? And if so, how are we going to stop them? And what punishment should they have?
Yes, I don't think that anyone's really trying to do that on purpose.
Yep.
But just as we mentioned with Facebook, basically you have very smart people who don't have, because they're not talking, because they're extremely smart, very high skills, but that they're so focused in a very narrow part of the problem that they don't realize what are the repercussions across society. So, that's why I keep bringing Facebook. I mean, Facebook is not out there to be evil.
Yeah.
But they are out there to maximize their profits, which is a valuable priority of companies. Unfortunately, the way in which they managed to do that was by making sure that people spend more time on their platform. And to do that, it turns out that their algorithms keep pushing more and more polemic and divisive kind of platforms.
Yes.
Which has created this kind of polarized people and basically also the ability to cut people and stop them having dialogues also emphasize that. So you basically create all these polarized kind of wars. I mean, going back to the crypto world, you find this very, very simple. You have people in crypto who only talk among themselves about how beautiful crypto is.
Yeah.
And then you have all these economists and other people who keep talking about how bad crypto is.
But they never
get to get into one place. And this is one of the consequences of Facebook making sure that all the crypto people are happy and they keep engaging within Facebook and all the And all the traditional people are happy because they keep talking to each other within Facebook as well. I mean, both share Facebook as a platform, but they never talk to each other.
They never come together. You're right.
They never come together, but basically that is creating divisions. It's breaking some communities. So unfortunately, it's not like a super villain. It's like a billionaire start creating something to not benefit society. It's simply that they're very smart doing something, and then they don't realize what are the implications of the other things. Again, let's take Tesla. Tesla was developed to as a way to create electric cars, which are very good which are supposed to be very good for the environment, minimize climate emissions, etc. Now the questions are, we have this initial vision that electric cars are very good for the environment, but are they very good for environment from a total perspective? So what happens to the electronics, what happens to the batteries, how are they being going to be recycled, can they be recycled, what happens with the mining that is being used to get all these minerals from Earth to create batteries and chips.
Wow, I didn't think of that.
Exactly, Tesla was created because people say, commission cars are very bad pollution contamination. If we create electric cars, we're going to reduce all of that. And it is true, there's a percentage, but that creates other issues that need to be taken into account. And again, the billionaire, I mean, Elon Musk is not out there thinking that he's going to destroy the world.
Yeah.
But we need to realize, but all this money,
the emissions that Tesla have saved is probably taken with his rocket.
those things, exactly.
Yeah.
So there are no supermen. It's simply
nobody's out there to be an evil supervillain, but some of the actions that they do are bad for us, in a nutshell.
That's why regulations. I mean, many people complain about that, but they are the lagging indicator of whenever people think about ethics, they say, we have to introduce regulations. So people have to be more involved on these regulations. Yeah. And obviously AI is become regulated, and there are quite a few open discussions about what needs to be done, etc. And people have to be involved in them, trying to figure out what other regulations. In Europe, there is a few new regulations, GDPR. I mean, all these things. People keep complaining that it enforces too much red tape on companies.
Yeah.
But if you see it for us as a consumer, I mean, the fact that you can now ask companies to delete your data is pretty powerful. From your perspective, it's actually quite good. I mean, it can be improved. All these things can always be improved, and that's why people need to be involved, understand what are the regulations.
Yeah.
The same thing with AI and banking. In Europe, actually, in AI and banking, in Europe, you're supposed to be always ask a human being the reasons why a certain decision was made or not. So if, for instance, if you go to a bank and your credit is rejected or your credit is reduced, you have the right now to ask them why, and they cannot just say, well, it's because the computer says so.
Right. You need explanatory requirements, yeah.
Exactly, which actually, from an academic perspective, is actually quite interesting, because now you have all this area of explainable AI that's been developed to try to explain models that can be extremely powerful, but there's no way for a highly skilled academic to explain. But
I saw a TikTok yesterday where somebody was saying I built a module in 5 minutes, but it's taken me hours and hours and hours to explain how I did that so quickly. I think that goes a long way, doesn't it? So have you got anything to promote or to talk about before we go?
I'm working with this company, the whiskey company. So we're trying to do some fun stuff there with the particular word, because it's so new and they're not encumbered by any kind of legacy systems. We're looking at to see how things can be done on the crypto space as user. We don't want to buy and sell tokens. We want actually to use the blockchain as a store of information and somewhere where people can just go out and interact. So this is one area we're trying to expand. And then on that, I've been in touch with other crypto applications, which are becoming interesting. I would recommend people to get a little bit more understanding of the crypto space, because from a top view, it looks like there is a lot of hacking, there's a lot of malicious software, etc. But if people spend some time and try to actually develop tools to use those blockchains for purposes, I think that they will acquire skills that are going to be very useful. Not only now. I mean, right now there is a huge lack of people with crypto skills for many projects. Many people are thinking of that they want to do X, Y, and Z on the crypto space, and it turned out that there are not enough engineers. And obviously, that drives the salaries high. Mm-hmm. So, for anyone who has those skills now, they can command a very good salary. But what will happen as well is that I foresee, just like the internet, that in which all these HTML skills kind of started to be needed by traditional companies. Yeah, traditional companies will end up having to build stuff on Web3 crypto space, and having those skills are going to be very useful. So I certainly recommend people to look and acquire skills now when it's.
And then you can be top of your game when it all kicks off.
Yes.
Gerardo, thank you so much for coming on to the show. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you. I'll make sure that I get those links from you so I can pop them on the show notes. Thank you very much. I appreciate you.
Hey, well, likewise.